Right, ready?
That's not your real cough.
I'm just trying to clear my throat, man. I've got like a little tickle on the go. It's doing my tits in.
I was going to say, because that's not your real cough.
No.
That's the cough you make when someone in front of you is taking too long in a queue.
Yeah, or if like someone says something like a little bit too left-wing or a little bit too right-wing and you're like...
Right, Mr. Centrist. A little bit too left-wing or a little bit too right-wing. There's a very narrow band in the middle that I'll accept.
I don't care for either extreme. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
Give me beige. That's what I'm aiming.
Give me beige. All right, fine.
Ready?
Ready when you are, boss, yeah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Every Movie Ever podcast. My name is Ben Groves.
And my name is Rob McFarlane. Welcome to the show, a movie podcast / mental health check-in with two broken-brained best friends laughing the pain away with film. Given that this is our weekly check-in, we have two mates checking that the other one's all right. Before I get to what we're doing, Ben, that's not as important as how are you doing? How is this film relevant to your week?
Okay.
You feeling? Where's your brain at? I know where your brain's at. It's in the fucking toilet. But tell the people, Ben.
It's fine. I'm just tired. And then I'm tired of being tired. And the anxiety needs to fuck off. I think I'm just tired of it.
Right.
That's it.
Okay.
I'm just tired. Yeah. That's it, really. I'm doing gym a lot. I'm trying to tire myself out as much as I can. That's...
Lucky man.
That's good. Works fine.
Works fine.
It's fine. Everything's fine. Just aggressively fine. Aggressively fine.
Right. It's cool. I'm going to edit all this for time anyway. Because this is just awful, Ben. This is the worst start to a show we've had in ages.
It's fine. this film, relevant to my week by it having one of the darkest, weirdest, most insane storylines ever. But everyone is completely fine with it because it has a few bangers in there.
Yeah, mate.
So what I've done is I've tried to steer into that and go, it doesn't matter how like dark and weird it gets, just
you just sing.
Just bare tooth.
Yeah.
Throw a bit of bare tooth in there and everything seems better. Weirdly, it kind of works.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Man. This is what I thought.
Yeah. What I thought. How are you? How's this film relevant to your week?
Well, so there was a reason I picked this. There's two reasons I picked this film. We're gonna get into it, but this film cheered me greatly. In lots of ways, actually. And I think you've already raised one issue. You know, look, I wanted to bring this film because Roger Corman died and I thought it was a great opportunity to cheer you up.
Okay. Who's Roger Corman?
Right. Roger Corman is like a legendary B-movie producer, right? So firstly, I thought you would have known about him and I thought you'd have been a bit sad. But realistically, as sad as it is that Roger Corman's dead, I'm more concerned that my friend's having a sad. You've been having a sad last week. You got reasons to be having a sad. And I thought if I could, my friend is sad and Roger Corman is dead. Now, if I can cash in on one while fixing the other, that would be a really good thing for the podcast, right? And although I regularly cash in on you being sad, I can't fix the fact that Roger Corman's dead.
Right.
So I thought we could do it the other way around.
Yeah. Sounds.
I could cash in on Roger Corman's death whilst trying to cheer you up.
No, I appreciate that, man.
I was convinced that this was a movie that you'd seen a lot as a kid. Mm-hmm. It's got Frank Oz animatronics. It's got Rick Moranis in it. It's got Bill Murray in it. It's got John Candy in it. It's got Steve fucking Martin in it. It's got a girl I knew you think was like, she looks like an alien. So Ben's going to like that.
She reminds me of, you know, that bit in Mars Attacks when the alien is like dressed up as the woman. Does that weird running thing down the hallway. She kind of looks like that. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
But fun.
Yeah. So I thought I could cheer you up with this film. And then when I was watching it, not only was I enjoying it and finding it funny and it was cheering up my week, I was sat there going, I'm such a good mate. And then I was also thinking, God, Roger Corman's dead. Loads of people are going to click on this. Honestly, mate, best film I've watched all week.
Mint. That's incredible. I'm glad you enjoyed it, man. That makes me feel better.
Now, this film came out well over 2 years ago, so there's a chance that some people may not have seen it. If you are one of those people who hasn't seen this film, it came out in 1986, and it had an odd budget.
Okay.
It cost $25 million.
Okay.
Which, for a film about a singing plant from outer space and a murderer,
yeah,
it seems like a lot, right?
Yes. That is,
but it's a remake. It's a remake of a Roger Corman classic. I'm going to get into the original film. I'm going to get into who Roger Corman is, why he's relevant to this. It then got made into an off-Broadway production as like a satire of 1950s movies.
Was I supposed to have watched the original film?
Yeah, yeah. We're doing the original Roger Corman movie.
Puck end.
No, we're doing the Rick Moranis remake.
No, I know we're doing Rick Moranis, but if we're going to get into the original... Okay.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about about who Roger Corman was.
I did not watch the original. I'm just going to put that one out there.
He's dead. He doesn't care. Do you know what I mean? It's not going to change his bank balance now, is it?
Who's the money going to now?
Right, exactly.
So, he didn't fucking make it.
But it came out in 1986 and it made $39 million, which is a decent showing for a movie this odd.
For the mid-80s as well, that's a lot, man.
Right, exactly. Right. Okay. I used to watch this a lot as a kid. My VHS of this was basically worn out.
Okay.
It was scratched a little itch. It was my kooky little 8-year-old me was all about this fucking film, basically.
Oh, I love that.
I found out, I was like, oh, I'm going to make Ben watch one of his childhood favorites. Then you're like, I've never seen this.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've seen it. Like, I've definitely seen the beginning. And I remember Steve Martin in the dentist scene. But right. I have a massive phobia of dentists, so same. I don't remember any of the film after the dentist scene, so I must have seen up to the dentist and gone, nope, I'm good.
Right, okay, nice. Okay, well, we've both got dental horror stories. Maybe we'll squeeze them in. For the benefit of those that haven't seen this film, because it is well over 2 years old, shall we break it down?
Yes, let's do it.
Shall we let them know what's going on? If you're not planning to see this film, stay tuned. If you, for some reason, have clicked on a podcast about a movie you haven't seen that you're planning to watch, This is your spoiler warning. After now, get fucked. We will be spoiling this, and that's on you.
Yeah, it's your fault. Enjoy it. Love you. Also, quickly, if we change the fucking jingle.
Yeah, it's different.
Oh, fuck's sake. All right. Sound.
just think I'm having a bit of breakdown. Come on. Breakdown.
All right, so I've written the breakdown this week. I've broken it down into three parts, Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. Each one has its own title. I have tried to keep it brief and sum up the story because the story is mental, but yeah, I've also tried to play it straight just so you can sort of hear how mental this story is. Picture it,
yeah.
Played straight, complete drama.
We don't need to sort of add to this because it's mad enough already. Yeah,
it's insane. Do you want to go first?
Yeah. So in the rundown neighborhood of Skid Row, we meet our main characters, Seymour Krelborn, a shy florist's assistant, Audrey, his kind-hearted co-worker with a troubled past, and Mr. Mushnick, the grumpy old owner of the flower shop. So Seymour, Audrey, and Mr. Mushnick. And with business being bad lately, Mr. Mushnick decides to close the doors to his business and call it a day. But as a saving grace to try and inspire Mr. Mushnick to keep trading, Seymour shows him his secret project. A yet undiscovered plant that was purchased from Chinatown during an unexpected solar eclipse. He names it Audrey 2 after his crush.
Why not?
The plant immediately, and I do mean immediately because Mr. Mushnick is like, no one's just going to knock on the door and go, wow, what an interesting plant. Guess what happens 2 seconds later?
Yep.
It is mint. Someone knocks on the door and goes, wow, what a strange and unusual plant. Let me buy some flowers.
Yeah.
It attracts customers and they all appear to talk like American 1950s commercials. It's incredible.
It is.
With business seemingly coming back to life, the pressure is on Seymour to keep Audrey 2 alive and thriving. Audrey 2 takes a turn for the worst, and after trying seemingly everything, Seymour accidentally discovers that Audrey 2 needs human blood to survive. He begins feeding the plant his own blood. Audrey 2 grows larger and hungrier.
Mm.
It's genderless, Audrey 2.
Mm-hmm.
It's a plant.
It is.
Audrey 2 has caused Mr. Mishnick's business to boom, and Seymour is becoming a local celebrity with more and more confidence to get closer to Audrey 1, his blonde, kind-hearted crush.
Yeah. Can't help that you didn't read Act 1 in the title. That's fine. Didn't specifically ask you to do that. No, it's fine.
That was Act 1.
It's too late now. It's too late now.
Hello, Seymour.
It's too late now. All right. It's too late now. Right, let me snap out of this, man. I'm fucking... Right, one sec. Ready? Balls! I'm ready. Ready?
Yeah.
Audrey 2 becomes increasingly demanding and begins talking to Seymour, revealing its manipulative nature to get what it wants. Audrey 2 promises Seymour fame and fortune, a way out of Skid Row for him and Audrey, in exchange for more human blood. Naturally, Seymour grows ever more conflicted between his moral compass and the desire for success and Audrey's affection. Seymour is struggling to keep up with Audrey 2's demands for blood. Audrey is trapped in an abusive relationship with sadistic dentist Orange Scrivello, Steve Martin. Sadistic. Mate, Steve Martin is fucking worst. No thank you, Steve Martin. No thank you. Audrey 2 convinces Seymour to kill Orin and sacrifice into the plant to satisfy... Audrey 2 convinces Seymour to kill Orin and sacrifice him to the plant to satisfy its hunger. But uh-oh! The sadistic dentist fucker accidentally kills himself, ODing on laughing gas. Good! Seymour chops up Orin's body and feeds him to Audrey 2, but unbeknownst to our shy little psychopath, Mr. Mushnick saw the whole ordeal.
Now we enter Act 3. In for a penny. In for a pound.
Thank you.
I like your little DCC. I committed to that one. You. I committed to that one twice as hard to make up for the fact that I completely forgot the first one.
It's all right. I moaned at you and then forgot about it immediately anyway. So fuck it. You know what I mean?
Audrey 2's appetite is now insatiable, demanding more bodies. Mr. Mushnick confronts Seymour, threatening to go to the police unless he hands over ownership of Audrey 2 to him, essentially stealing the fame and the fortune from Seymour. Unfortunately, Seymour has crossed the line that cannot be uncrossed and is now a full-blown murderer.
Full-blown!
As he inadvertently feeds Mr. Mushnick to Audrey 2. Seymour's guilt and paranoia grows, as does Audrey 2's fame, attracting more and more people, causing him to become more famous. Audrey 2's true intentions are now known to be world domination and destruction of the human species.
Bow, 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 bow!
Seymour confesses his crimes to Audrey, who's horrified, but still in love with him. Audrey 2 attempts to eat Audrey 1, but Seymour saves her, electrocutes Audrey 2, bringing peace back to his life. He marries Audrey 1, and they move to somewhere green with a little white picket fence. The film ends showing a little Audrey 2 in their new front yard, implying that this may only be the beginning.
So there we have it. Apparently murder pays. Plants are fucking evil. And even in the most desperate of neighborhoods, everyone still loves a bit of gardening.
Right. So I thought this film, all your loves, weird looking female leads.
Sure.
It's 50s sci-fi.
Sure.
Horror murder.
Yeah.
Bill Murray.
Bill Murray.
John Candy.
John Candy.
Fucking Rick Moranis.
Rick Moranis.
And gardening.
Yeah. I love all of them. But do you know what?
I don't know how many more of your loves I can smash into
I
one
know.
Film.
Do you know what outweighs my love for all of those put together?
Right.
My fear of dentists. What child grows up wanting to drill people's faces for money? That shit is psychopathic. I don't understand it. I can't sit there with my mouth open with someone with a drill. I'm just supposed to blindly accept that my entire face is numb? What? Fuck no. Absolutely not. It's giving me the fucking creeps talking about it.
It's not even that. It's the thing of like, I can't wait to have a numbed patient and do dentistry on them already fucked.
Yeah.
And then just do my job in the sort of aroma of burning bad tooth.
Dude, the worst thing about it is, right, is... Whenever I've had a tooth out or I've had something done to my teeth, they don't let me keep them. And I'm like, well, why do you need them?
Right. What are you doing with them?
That's mine.
What are you doing with them?
I've given you money to take my property out of my mouth.
Yeah.
Why do you need it? If you want it, it's the 120 quid that I've just paid.
Tooth fairy confirmed, I think. I think that's what it is. Obviously, the fantastical one, not the serial killer one. So you wrote some questions for me about this movie.
I did.
That I'd like to get into.
Sound. Okay.
Let me know.
The first one and my main one being, how the fuck does this film get away with being so dark and so insane? Mm-hmm. The storyline's mental. And all it does is throw in a few musical numbers. How does it just pass over as like some light, fun family entertainment.
You see, what I find fascinating about this is it sounds like you've already answered that question because you just put on a bit of bear tooth and you go, this is fine. This is fine.
Yeah, kind of.
You can do some really fucked up stuff if you just sing a little song while you do it. Then it's whimsical.
I'm not murdering people to feed to a fucking plant that I bought in Chinatown.
Are you not? Because look at it this way. Here's a song in Little Shop of Horrors. And it starts, and I went, oh my God, this is Telford. Downtown, where the folks are broke. You go downtown, where your life's a joke. You go downtown, where you buy your token. You go home to Skid Row, where the cabs don't stop, uh-huh. Where the food is slop, where the hop heads flop in the snow, down on Skid Row.
Mate, first off, we've got wicked food. All right. There's like a handful of solid restaurants around here.
Yeah, the food is quite solid. You're right.
Yes, because it's not all soup, because that would be insane, right? You posh bastard. Just because you eat nothing but soup and quiche.
I live on a diet of soup and gazpacho, and I spit it out and go, Alfred, this is cold.
Yeah. Oh, God. First off, rude. Second off,
right.
Good restaurants. Third off, the fuck is a token? Who in Telford is out?
It's Subway. Tokens. Subway tokens.
We don't have a Subway, so fuck you very much.
Yes, you do. I've been there because I got a 6-inch marinara from there, so you're a fucking liar.
Oh, we got a few. Yeah, to be fair. All right, my bad.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
My bad. Apologies. Thank you. It is Telford. Welcome to Skid Row.
So the reason this is a musical is an odd one. So we'll get into who Roger Corman was, but he made a low-budget sci-fi comedy, sci-fi horror comedy in 1960. So it's made in the 50s. And it was bad. It wasn't great. You know, it didn't do particularly well.
Okay.
But it was played a lot on American television. And so some off-Broadway producers came along and they loved it. It was just their little nerdy, culty special interest. And they made an off-Broadway musical about it.
Awesome.
Which became like a massive sleeper hit.
Okay.
So the film you're watching is a remake of that musical, which is a remake of that 1950s horror movie.
Right, okay.
And I think this film wouldn't be as enjoyable as it is if it was just a remake of the movie. So much of the joy and the humor and the satire comes from that Broadway production.
Right, okay.
Roger Corman himself was a very, very, very prolific movie director. He basically sort of pioneered make 'em regularly, make 'em cheap, and make a razor-thin margin, but that's fine, you're already on to the next one.
Right, okay.
This film, that the Little Shop of Horrors, the original that he made, was shot in 2.5 days.
Wow.
And he'd made a film called The Bucket of Blood.
A Bucket of Blood? Is that Roger Corman?
That's Roger Corman.
I know Bucket of Blood.
Right, do you know Death Race 2000?
Yes, obviously I know Death Race 2000.
Do you know Swamp Women?
Yes, I know Swamp Women.
Yeah, these are all Roger Corman movies.
Oh my God, I know Roger Corman. He's dead.
Right, exactly. He's dead,
and now I'm sadder.
No, you're not. No, I'm not. We're doing a pun.
No, I'm not.
But he used to make films backwards. So someone would submit a idea for a film.
Oh, right.
He'd go, oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
He'd get a poster made. He'd cast it. He'd put those actors on the poster.
Right.
And then he would test that with audiences,
right,
to see how well the idea polled with the audience.
Well, this
and
makes
if it was successful,
sense.
Then he'd write the script, shoot it as quick as possible. He'd plan everything.
Right.
So like every shot, every line, there would be no improvisation. There'd be nothing. He'd be like, no, we don't have the budget. Bang, 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 done.
Right.
Edit it, release it, move on to the next one.
I thought you meant he literally made films backwards, like in reverse. You know, like the credits started.
No, 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 no. He's not Christopher Nolan.
Credits started rolling up the screen. You know what I mean? Like
just moonwalking around on set.
Yeah, yeah.
In the process of doing this, though, he produced early films from Francis Ford Coppola.
Okay.
Martin Scorsese.
Okay.
Jonathan Demme.
Ooh.
Got the careers of Sylvester Stallone.
Naturally.
Jack Nicholson,
okay.
William Shatner.
Ooh.
Like, he was the guy, if you wanted a chance and you had what you thought was a good idea, he'd go, yeah, all right, I'll give you a chance. Let's see how you go with it.
That's fucking awesome.
And in the result, made like some incredible movies, a bunch of shit, but also some incredible movies. And almost all of them are like cult classics.
Incredible. What a fucking guy. What an absolute guy. So, the storyline in Little Shop of Horrors, I just need to quickly like go over it because Seymour is taken in by Mr. Mushnick, right? He's like, he's found on the street. He's given a place to live. He's given a job. He's given an income in exchange for obviously like him working as a floral assistant.
Yes.
So the fact that the film plays out where he's like, nah, bud, I'm trying to get me some Audrey. Fuck this guy that saved my entire life. I'm just going to feed him to a plant that's going to make me more famous and give me and Audrey a way out of Skid Row.
Yeah.
It's a weird character arc, right? It's a weird character arc to sort of...
For a hero of a movie,
For Rick Moranis being the hero of a musical, a fun musical horror comedy, it's a weird character arc to sort of sit there and go, oh, this song's great, and then go, he's just murdered the one person that gave him a chance. Okay, that's cool. Yeah, I see where this is going. But it's fine, because everyone else is sitting there snapping their fingers going, God, I love this song. Boo-doo-boo-doo, and I'm like, yeah, it's a good song. He is a psychopath, though, right? He is he is a full-blown psychopath. Speaking of psychopaths, we've got Steve Martin, who is a bigger psychopath, the most sadistic piece of shit I've ever seen, and it's Steve Martin. I hated every second of it. Hated every second of it. Couldn't get into it.
I quite like his character. I like the sort of outlandishness of that character.
Yeah.
I like the fact that he is... Something that this film does very cliverly is it takes kind of 50s cliche.
Okay.
And it zooms in on it to a degree where suddenly it's ridiculous.
Right.
Steve Martin is the James Dean bad boy. He's got a leather jacket.
He's
got a motorbike. He's a bit of a prick, right?
Yeah, he's got Elvis mouth.
Yeah. And it's that 50s rock and roller taken to the logical extreme.
Right.
And you're like, well, now this is ridiculous. The Rick Moranis character is very much the same. Do you ever read Silver Age Marvel comics? I had a whole stack of them. My grandmother used to collect them. They'd always have adverts in the back for the Charles Atlas workout routine.
There'd always be some guy
getting sand kicked in his face at the beach, right? And they took that guy getting sand kicked in his face at the beach and they just wrote him as a character, and that's Rick Moranis.
He's got
so little agency in this film. He makes no decisions. Things happen to him. Like, he decides that he's going to kill... the dentist. He's going to kill Steve Martin's character,
Oren.
And he goes there with a gun. Does he kill him? Does he fuck?
No.
The dentist ODs on laughing gas. So he's just sort of carried along by the winds of life and doesn't have the willpower to go, actually, no, I'm going to step in here and do something. He always tries to do something, and he doesn't even kill Mushnick. Mushnick's so greedy that he ends up falling into the plant.
I think that was a murder by omission, because he could have been like,
take
a step back.
But that's it. His whole life is by omission.
I guess.
And so this film is like a kind of, it's like cliches taken to the logical conclusion.
Okay.
It's the weediest of wimps.
Yeah.
It's the most rocker of rockers. It's the most Jewish florist you've ever seen taken to, do you know what I mean?
I see what you mean.
He doesn't say oy vey, but he's a New York florist.
Sure.
He's got the belt and braces.
Sure.
We know who this is. Audrey's got a lisp, and she's the biggest bimbo you've ever seen.
She is. I think the one in Mars Attacks would have had like been able to hold more of a conversation.
100%.
Even though the only words that she could speak is agak. You know what I mean?
I get the dentist phobia thing. I had a horrific...
Oh, 1,000%.
Should we trade dental horror stories?
Sure.
So mine comes from, I had a bad tooth in the roof of my mouth, right?
Okay.
I was 18. It was near my 18th birthday. And because I'm not, wasn't comfortable with dentists, I was like, I'll just leave it. It got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I went to the dentist eventually because it was killing me. And they're like, it's going to have to come out.
Okay.
But there wasn't enough of the tooth left to grab it with like pliers.
Ugh.
What they had to do is they had to go inside the tooth root.
Yeah.
And then like use this tool that like gets wider when you twist the handle.
Yeah.
So it's like it's expanding inside the cavity, and then you can pull the tool and the tooth comes out.
Right.
So she does this and it slips out. So she does it again. She makes it wide. It slips out. She's like, right, okay.
Fuck no.
So she really pushes, and then there's this pop and I'm like, oh, it's out. And she goes, oh, okay. So she gets her fingers, her thumb and fingers, she closes my nose, and she goes, could you breathe out through your nose? I'm like, okay. So I breathe out through my nose while she's holding my nose closed, and then this noise comes from my mouth, which is like, And what she's done is she's knocked a hole through my tooth into my sinus. So now when I breathe out through my nose, air is blowing out through the tooth.
I don't know. I don't want to hear this. I don't know how to handle the fucking horror show that's going on in my brain right now.
And so they wheel me into the next room. They're like, right, we're going to have to stitch it up. They start stitching it up and I'm shitting myself at this point. Like I'm sweating like a crackhead on Christmas Day, right?
Right.
And they pop the chair back and I'm saved because there's a massive fucking Where's Wally poster. Where's Waldo for our American cousins?
Sure.
Right? On the ceiling and I'm like, wicked. Yeah. I'm just gonna live in Waldo's fantastical world and there's the cunt.
Oh, right. Found him immediately.
Yeah. Immediately. Fuck that, man. And then I was like, shit, now I'm gonna have to look for the fucking wizard and I'm just not as invested.
Yeah, like, fuck that guy, man. Like, just let him be lost. You know what I mean? The coach is leaving Rome and he's still sightseeing. Just let him be. You know, I mean, this is where he lives.
Where's yours come from?
My phobia comes from, it's nowhere near as bad as that story because that is fucking horrendous. Having someone manually drill into your sinus through your gum line is the worst thing I can think of. Honestly, didn't even think it was a possibility. Now that's unlocked new.
Neither did I.
Yeah, that's unlocked new phobias. Mine is, I once went to the dentist and he was like, you need a root canal. And I was like, I don't want one.
Mm-hmm.
And bear in mind, I'm a kid at this point. And he's like, well, no, you need one because your face is swollen. We need to do something about it. You need a root canal. Yeah. And I was like, okay, fine. But I don't want the needle. And he was like, what? And I was like, I don't want the needle because I'm scared of needles. And he was like, I can't do a root canal without numbing your face because it is incredibly painful. I drill into a nerve that is next to your brain. And I was like,
yes,
it's fine. I can probably take it. Spoiler, I could not take it. I argued the man down so that I did not have the needle, and he did a full root canal in my mouth with no anesthetic, and I have never wanted to kill myself more.
it
was horrendous, like awfully horrendous, and I've just never, I can't get back into it, man.
Why would you?
I know I was a kid. And I was being a dickhead, right? But what sort of adult human who does this for
listens
a living
to
a
listens
to a kid? I'd have punched me in the face and just done it anyway.
Honestly, that dentist must have thought all his chickens had come home to roost.
This is what I'm saying.
He was there being like, oh yeah, not only do I get to do it, I get to do it with anesthetic.
On this little prick.
All my wet dreams.
This little prick all my wet dreams fucking arguing with me. I'm already hard thinking about it. Fuck no. Nah. I just can't trust people that want to grow up and drill people's faces for a living. It's too much.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Martin in this film, that's all, he nails it because that's how I imagine every dentist to be outside of work. I imagine there to be like some sort of behind the dental surgery, just a sea of motorcycles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 100%.
And laughing gas masks. That's all I see. That's all I can imagine. I'm not into it.
It's got a good song.
It does. The one thing that I picked up on this film is I'm not big into musicals, right? It's not a big thing
for
me.
Yeah, yeah.
I struggle with them because I don't fully understand the context of like the backup singers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In this film, they act as like narrators, right? Which is understandable. Yeah. They sort of, you know, they narrate the thing. But who can see them? Is it just for us? Or are they like in the minds of one of the characters in the film? Do they exist in the film universe? How does it work?
So it changes from musical to musical, right? And one of the things that I despise the most about musicals is when people just start singing and that's apparently how they communicate, right?
Okay.
But it comes back to, if you look at, think early cinema, think Singing in the Rain, right? That's a sort of classic musical that you'd have watched with your mum.
Yeah.
When you were a kid, you didn't draw that distinction between this is film, this is music. It was all just one thing, right?
Yeah, but I think Singing in the Rain is a difficult example because it kind of makes sense in context with itself,
right?
Whereas a lot
because
of musicals,
they're making a film,
like the back,
they're making a musical,
exactly. Yeah, do you see what I mean? It makes sense within the context of it, but whereas just having three people wander through a scene that no one can see them and they're going, he's about to get murdered, he's about to get shot in the mouth. It's like, who can see
this? It's a callback to earlier forms of art, right? So. You would previously have opera was your narrative enjoyment.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You would go see a play or you'd go see an opera And musicals kind of are the popular descendant of opera.
Okay.
So there's three characters in this, the three black girls.
Yeah.
Right? Renette, Chiffon, and Crystal.
Yes.
Who were all named after 50s Motown bands.
Right.
And they're little girls in school uniform for a lot of the film. But then when a musical number comes on, they are in full stage costume.
Yes.
Now, when they're in full stage costume, they're performing the role of what's called a Greek chorus.
Right.
So the Greek chorus is a group of actors who are like the narrator for a opera or for a choral thing.
Okay.
They exist outside of the characters. They are like...
Right.
Usually they're the fates or they're this kind of thing. So they're the bit where the playwright can catch you up on what's been going on off stage or that
kind
of
thing. So it's for us.
It's for us.
And no one can see it.
No one can see them. Okay. So the characters can only see them as young schoolgirls.
Right, okay.
You can tell
that
because there's a scene where it's raining and they're not getting wet. And I still don't fucking know how that was achieved.
Oh. I need to watch this again, man. Because it's like, there's too much to it. I watched Hairspray once in the cinema and I walked out going, I don't fucking understand anything that just happened. I don't understand it.
Hairspray's an odd place to start. And different musicals take different approaches.
Oh,
so some
fuck it. That's,
are
that's,
very realistic.
It's so
like
annoying.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch, my favourite film of all time, is unfortunately a musical.
No, it's a great musical.
It makes sense. But it's a great film because they're a band.
Yes.
And the songs are the songs they're performing on stage that just so happen to mirror what the songwriter is going through. But then that makes sense because songwriters write from their own lives.
Plus also having the unreliable narration come from an unreliable narrator who is the lead singer and the orchestrator of all of this makes perfect sense because you know not to trust it wholeheartedly. It's coming from one person's narration. You only get one side of the story, right? And it's Hedwig and the Angry Inch is a perfect example of what I would say is a perfect example of a musical done incredibly well. It's insanely good.
It's a perfect
good.
Film. I will die on the hill that is one of the best films I've ever... It is the best film I've ever seen.
Wow.
For me personally, and it's my all-time favourite.
Have you seen Tremors 4?
I haven't. It's probably why Hedwig's my favourite.
It's the prequel.
Because I've not... Yeah. Right, okay, nice, nice.
See?
I tell you what, though, there are... talking musicals that deal with the narrative and where the songs exist in it.
Yeah.
Being completely different. A good example is The Little Mermaid. And I bring it up because the songs in this film...
Yeah.
Same guy.
It's The Little Mermaid.
Yeah. He
wow,
went from writing
man. He fell
Little
off.
Shop of Horrors...
Right.
To what? Under the Sea.
Under the Sea's fine.
That's the one he wrote. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's fine. I played in a school steel band, you know, like the... Jamaican oil drum
so
instruments and stuff. Yeah. I was the drummer in a band, and Under the Sea was one of the fucking songs that we used to play. shout out to the Lord Silk and Steel Band, by the way. Yeah, buddy.
I mean, it didn't happen, mate. I'm just saying.
I tried to find one not too long ago. We played for the Queen in Hawaii when we were all wearing Hawaiian shirts. I had a little afro. I can't remember.
You look mint in a Hawaiian shirt. You should bring that back.
Mate, I need to get a Hawaiian... I'm going to treat myself to a Hawaiian shirt. I'm going to get one made
Do
up.
It.
Yeah, man. I feel like that's going to... That's going to snap me out of my funk. I'm going to go get a Hawaiian shirt and just wear it religiously. Mint.
You absolutely should.
Yeah, I'm into it, man. I'm into it. Okay, so we've got that one sorted. My next question, which I think is possibly the most important question about this film that I could have conceived.
Right. Okay.
Bill Murray's character.
Yeah, Bill Murray's in this film. He appears as a patient of the sadistic dentist played by Steve Martin, who kind of ruins it for Steve Martin because he's a masochist. And
yes.
He's just madly into it. He's like, hello, doctor. I think I need a root canal.
Yeah.
A long, slow root
canal. Yeah. It's disgusting. It's the worst.
Like, everything Steve Martin's character does to Bill Murray just fucking loves it. And Steve Martin's like, get out, you disgust me.
Yeah. But maybe that's the dentist's one weakness. Maybe I just need to really be into getting my teeth all fucking drilled and stuff, and then dentists
Mate,
just won't want to...
Lie back in the chair, just full tent in your trousers.
Oh, God, no. Fuck me. No, it's freaking me out. You're just saying lie back in the chair, and I'm like, oh, no, I don't want to go. So Pete,
but yeah, Bill Murray's in
Bill
it.
Bill Murray's in it, and the main question that was going through my head is he is really over the top. He's very animated. Mm-hmm. He's very exaggerated, and I was thinking, could this be Peter Venkman in his experimental years? Could this be like where he branches out? He's like, you know, I've done, you know, I've chased Dana. We're off doing our own thing, but maybe there's a little piece of me that's like, maybe I just need a dentist to fuck my mouth with a drill for a bit.
Jesus.
Do you know what I mean? So I think that's the most important question that I've taken away from Little Shop of Horrors. Is this Pete Venkman in his experimental years?
I mean, it's interesting. I'm not sure it is. I think Venkman, if he was a masochist, would have been a weirder character in Ghostbusters. I think he'd have really bonded with Viggo.
Ooh, that's a shout.
He'd have been like, I sit on a throne of blood, and Ray would have been like, we're going to stop you, and Bill Murray would be like, whoa.
Yeah, let's just
hear me out.
Let's hear him out. Let him cook.
This is a mad one, but hear me out. Let him cook. So I'm not sure it's Venkman, but I've got a fun fact.
Okay.
And this genuinely surprised me.
Okay.
There's two facts about this.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, Steve Martin's dentistry tools that he uses on Bill Murray.
Yes.
You've seen them before.
In
da 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 dun 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 da 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 dun dun dun.
Are you having a stroke? What's happening?
Batman 1989. It's the same tools that they use on the Joker.
Hold on. What fucking song is that? Da 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 dun dun dun.
Yeah, that's the theme.
Is it?
Yeah.
Bro, I haven't watched that film since we covered it.
Yeah,
and
it's
that
the theme.
I don't think I've ever heard that song once.
Well, you've made me doubt it now.
I always thought it was Batman.
That's Adam West. I'm having to fucking play it on YouTube now in one headphone.
Come on. That is wildly different to what you just sang me.
Yeah, okay. I can't remember what the theme I just sang is. So if a listener could get in touch, everymovieeveruk@gmail.com or on the socials.
Let us know how close we were on a scale of one to what the fuck just happened.
Dun-dun-dun.
I don't think that...
Dun-dun-dun.
It kind of sounds like a toy commercial.
Okay, that's first fact. Batman.
Cool.
Same tools used on the Joker.
Awesome.
By Jack Nicholson. Second fact, this is the only film in existence that Bill Murray and Steve Martin are both in. And that
That doesn't seem real.
No, it doesn't, does it?
But that's incredible.
But then you think about it and you're like, oh, yeah.
Okay. I need to. I'm going to research that more. There's got to be some sort of like B movie early thing, something knocking about. There has to be just something.
And then there's a bonus fact that none of Bill Murray's dialogue was scripted, and it made the scene a nightmare to edit. They had to ask him to tone it down.
How?
Because they couldn't get continuity. Toned down?
I fucking love that man so much, but how is that toned down? He's insane,
right?
Okay.
I mean, it's a testament to the quality of 1980s cocaine, I think.
Oh man, yeah. 1,000%. He was loving life. He must have shot that entire scene in about 11 minutes. And then the editor was like, you need to calm down. And he's like, huh?
Can we for a moment, I want to focus on this.
Okay.
Audrey 2 as a puppet.
Yes.
There's no post-production. There's no CGI. It is all done in camera.
Okay.
And I don't think I've ever seen practical effects work, practical puppetry, as good as Audrey 2 since this film. I don't think it's been bettered.
Jabba was pretty good.
Jabba's mouth flaps open and closed.
And his arms.
With no articulation.
His arms were different
people.
And
his little arms move.
I've got an autograph from Jabba's left arm.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
Oh my God.
He signed it Jabba's left hand man.
Okay. Okay, that's excellent. Right? That is excellent.
Yeah.
But for me personally,
okay,
it's still the plant.
It's an insane puppet. I've not seen puppetry like this, and it was
right.
It's an absolute delight to watch.
For me, it's the fact that it's like it's a giant mouth mm-hmm. on top of a stork neck.
Yes.
And the lips individually articulate to present different vowel sounds.
Okay.
And they do it rapid.
Yeah.
And do you remember the old iMac that was just a screen and then there was a little stork and then there was like the bass?
Are you on about the Apple iMac, the very first
one?
Yeah.
The very first one.
Yeah.
It's imagine that upside down and then go, now make it have a mouth that moves using just cables and five fuckers.
Yeah.
I'd be like,
But also, this is 1986, so they'd be terrified looking at a Mac. They'd be like, what is this magic box?
Okay, fair point. But I think it's the peak of his work. And the way they achieved it is insane.
Okay.
So Audrey 2 as a plant moves really quickly and moves really fluidly and moves really naturally.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Love that. The way they achieved that was they filmed a huge portion of Audrey 2's scenes at half speed. So they would film at 12 frames per second rather than 24. So that when they played it back at regular speed, Audrey 2 was moving twice as quick.
Does that mean that the actors had to act in half speed?
Yeah, they had to mime their scenes in half speed.
Oh my God, that's insane.
And it gets worse because the entire thing was filmed in Pinewood in England, right?
Okay. That's cool.
They didn't want to do location so that like even the shot outside the florist with like a couple of blocks worth, that's in a set, right?
No way.
But because it's massive, they can't heat the stage.
Oh,
like it's just unheated.
Yeah.
So everyone's breath was condensing on camera. It was so cold that they were getting like steam coming out of their mouths.
Fucking hell.
So they had to put ice in their mouths to stop their breath condensing. So Rick Moranis is there,
man. So
working in halftime with his face inches away from a puppet five times his size. The puppeteers can't see shit, and he's just got a mouthful of ice cubes miming in halftime.
What, and, mate? To be fair to him, right? I'd have quit acting too. Do you know what I mean? I'd have been like, you know what? I think I'm all right, to be honest. This was a shit show. This is insane.
I would prefer that reason. I would prefer that to be the reason that Rick Moranis quit acting. For those that don't know, he had kids, had a wife. The wife sadly passed away of cancer. And so he took a break from acting to raise his children and then just went, actually,
this is lovely.
Kind of mint.
Yeah. Which is a fucking it's a lovely, you know, story for Rick Moranis, apart from the dead wife, but the rest of it is lovely.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
good on Rick Moranis.
It's better than Liam Neeson's dead wife story.
Yeah. I
know who I'd rather have at dinner.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if like Rick Moranis was a normal Hollywood dad. Imagine if Rick Moranis was Woody Allen. You know what I mean? I mean, Rick Moranis is like the anti Woody Allen. It's crazy. I didn't realise that this film had two fucking endings, if I'm honest with you, bud.
Okay, I'm going to be honest with you too.
Yeah.
I didn't until I watched it for this and went, nah, that's not real. That's not what happens.
So,
because I downloaded the director's cut.
I did the exact same thing and I watched it and I was, when it got to the ending, right, I was like, this entire film's got to be built into something real. It's got to be built into some sort of like, you know, pinnacle point where everything before it makes sense. And the director's cut did exactly that for me. It's 10 minutes
of
a creature feature with a very deep romantic, you know, final sacrifice and a confession of true unabounded love. It was perfect for me. I was like, what a fucking film. What a fucking film. That's incredible. And I went to the Boardroom Gaming Cafe and I was sitting and I was having a chat in there about this film and was informed that is the director's cut ending, not the theatrical ending. And I was like, for what do you mean?
So in the theatrical cut,
it's shit.
He murders a bunch of people.
Yes.
He then confesses his crimes to Audrey, electrocutes the plant.
Yeah.
And they go on to live happily ever after.
Yeah.
Completely consequence-free for their murders.
He gets away with all of it. Everything goes fucking, it all comes up fucking swimmingly for Seymour.
Comes up roses, you might say.
Oh, there we go.
No, so the original director's cut that we both watched ends slightly differently.
Yeah.
Overcome with guilt, he heads to the roof after feeding Audrey 1 to Audrey 2. She's been attacked by the plant.
Mm-hmm.
She dies in his arms and she says, look, It's going to make you more famous if that plant grows. Feed me to the plant.
You are skimming over one of the most beautiful moments of this entire film.
Right.
The speech that she gives him broke me. Holy fuck, did that break me. She's just been attacked by the plant that she found out Seymour has been feeding people to, right?
Yeah.
And rather than go, you're a fucking psychopath, help me. She's like, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
But you're such a lovely person. I want you to get everything that you deserve. Thank you for everything. Feed me to the plant. It's going to help you in the long run. You know, just do it for me.
Beautiful.
And I was like,
and then he lovingly places her in the plant's mouth.
Oh, God.
The plant eats her. And then he goes to the roof.
He does.
And a guy's like, hey, man, I'm going to make you a billionaire. Because guess what? I got some seeds from the plant. And he's got a little Audrey too.
Yeah.
And he's like, and we've got thousands of these. And we're going to distribute them. We're going to charge loads of money for them. You'll get a royalty off the top. You're made for life. And he's like, oh, my God. And the little seedling like turns and looks at him and does a little menacing look. And he's like,
a little smile.
Yeah, I realize now what this is. He goes down, he confronts the plant. He's like, you're a fucker. This is all about world domination.
Yeah.
There's a great song. The plant fucks the florists up.
Yeah.
Eats Seymour.
Yeah.
And then there's a 10-minute montage of plant monsters just shit mixing New York.
It's incredible. And eating the Golden Gate Bridge. And then
climbing the Statue of Liberty.
So good.
Right?
It's so good.
Which is probably the only other time that this film crosses over with Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Because there are no Ghostbusters in the Statue of Liberty. So, but
there's none.
So that's the ending I watched, and it's brilliant. And that's the ending that they filmed, and they spent millions filming it. There's a load of practical effects works in there. There's a train that gets eaten by a plant.
Yeah.
There's like fucking car crashes. There's thousands of extras running down streets.
It's incredible.
And they showed it to test audiences, and it tested under 50%. The audience fucking hated it. And what was weird is that it was the ending of the stage play.
Yeah. But that's
so the musical on Off-Broadway had that ending.
Which is great.
Yeah, it's a great ending.
And it should have stayed that way because like the alternative ending or the director's cut ending, Seymour is so down on his luck and desperate to make something of himself.
Mm.
He has this huge crush on Audrey who he views as sort of like, you know, this very elegant.
Ethereal being.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so what he does is he literally drains his own life force. Like he takes the blood from within him to feed the thing that is helping him grow closer to Audrey, helping the business boom, helping himself get a better income, giving himself better prospects. When he starts getting famous, he's got plasters over every finger. He's desperately trying to squeeze more blood out of his things. Like he's literally killing himself to feed his betterment or what he perceives to be his betterment.
Yep.
And for it all to fucking blow up in his face and cost him everything is a beautifully fitting ending. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It's the lesson there is invaluable. The fucking one that we got in the theatrical release is, bleed yourself dry because guess what, buddy? You're going to get the girl. You're going to get the house. That white picket fence, boom, boom, boom. It's all yours, buddy.
But you got to remember it's Reagan's America at the time.
Sure.
And on a stage show, you can watch people for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And then you can watch them die. And then they come out at the end after the final song.
Okay,
and they take a bow and you're like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Whereas you spend 2 hours with the characters in Reagan's America in the original director's cut ending.
Yeah.
And then they die and the earth's fucked. And then it's like, have a good night.
Yeah. Like,
oh, well, that's a waste of time getting to know those people, wasn't it? Because they're dead now. Whereas with the stage, they come out, they take a bow. You're like, oh, what a jolly time. It was all make-believe. And Frank Oz hates the theatrical ending.
Good.
He fucking hates it.
Good. He's not the only one.
Considering, considering he's a man of makes the Muppets. I put stock by what he hates. You know.
Yeah.
So what are you gonna rate Little Shop of Horrors 1986, Ben?
I'm gonna rate the theatrical cut like a 5. It's fun.
Yeah, I'm about the same.
It's fun, but ultimately it doesn't mean anything in the end unless it was to spin off into like a franchise, into like a universe, and it builds on where Audrey 2 comes back and then he eventually pays the price for it. Then maybe I'm interested.
Right.
But theatrical verse, like 5. Director's cut, 8?
Ooh,
8.5?
Nice. Yeah. Fair.
It's incredible.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I don't know if I can find a film that has so many of your special interests in it again.
Yeah, I think finding all of those things in one basket without a dentist.
In one basket,
it's a tall order. It's a tall order.
Yeah.
I appreciate
it's
the effort,
the dentist
man.
Bit. They always pop a dentist in at the end, and I'm like, fuck's sake.
No, honestly, literally, Jurassic Park, boom, T-Rexes, Velociraptor, turns out to be a dentist, ruins the whole fucking film. Unreal.
No, there's dentistry in Jurassic Park because of the bad tooth in...
Oh my God, you're so right. Okay, hold on one sec. Tremors. The worms knocking about everywhere. Kevin Bacon leaping all over the place on the fucking long pole. Boom! Worms are dentist. You know what I mean?
Well, that's what it
See?
Is. Yeah.
It, man. That's it. It's difficult. Difficult. What are you going to rate it?
Oh, mate, it's a fat 10 for me. Fair. It's silly. It's irreverent. It's a satire of a bunch of stuff I love. I love 50s sci-fi. I love creature features. I love rock and roll. I love 50s romances. To have them all satirized this well and to be this ridiculous and this fun is just, it's just a good time. It's a good, good time. And I can't hate it. I just can't hate it. I watched it too many times on VHS as an 8-year-old to hate it.
It makes me and much happier than I was to see how happy you are right now. This is
good.
This is good.
Right.
I'm really happy that we did this. Thank you for bringing this onto the table.
You're welcome. And I got a couple other things that are going to cheer you up. So,
okay.
Comment corner time, motherfucker.
Yeah, buddy.
Bumper week.
Okay.
So first and foremost, I want you to get your phone out. I want you to open Instagram.
Hold on.
I want you to scroll to some messages that we received from Oscar Brett.
All right, one sec. I threw my phone over here. One second.
Oh, well, do you know what? I'll read Oscar Brett.
Okay.
Because he's in my camp.
Oh, right. Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah,
Oscar
sound.
Oscar starts. This is regarding a mate of yours, Bailey.
Oh, okay.
Saying
yeah.
that Citizen Kane was dog shit. And I said, get in touch with a rebuttal. Oscar Brett's got in touch. I have nothing but respect for Bailey. Any friend of Ben is a friend of mine. Mm. And all opinions are valid and fair.
Yeah.
However, I've never heard such bullshit on such a categorical, organized level in my life. Hearing that Citizen Kane's cinematography is just fine, quotes, felt like an aneurysm. And it's just a brave thing to say in public. What do you even mean? I'd rather be a film nerd huffing my own farts than have maybe the most objectively wrong opinion to ever exist. Some movies are good. And some movies are so good, you feel like you've been physically impregnated.
Yeah.
Terminator, Jurassic Park.
Evil Dead.
And then there's Citizen Kane.
Evil Dead 2.
And then there's Citizen Kane and maybe The Godfather on a whole other tier. And Army of Darkness. They've added that.
Okay.
Subtlety does not necessarily a good film make, especially when it's something made in the 1950s. It's allowed to be heavy-handed.
Yeah.
The urge to be different has taken over the mind of Gen Z and the millennials and erased them of the enlightenment of Wells. And then they've added, obviously all jokes aside, nothing but love. I just hope that Bailey can join us on the right side of history and see the light that Orson is able to capture through his gorgeous framing and visuals. Now, good day to you, sir.
Okay, first off, Oscar Brett, thank you for the rebuttal to that. It's interesting to see the other side of the coin. I first need to address the Gen Z millennial thing. We are classed as elder millennials. We exist...
Exennials.
Yes, we exist on the very... We were the cusp of the millennial cake. You know what I mean? This is why we're all depressed and fucking lost. We have no clue what was going on.
We miss Friendster too much.
Yeah, this is what I mean. Fucking BlackBerry ruined it all. You know what I mean? You don't remember, man. And thirdly, I'm still Team Bailey on this one, man. I'm still Team Bailey on it.
Well, we're going to have to settle it by covering it at some point, aren't we?
I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to get two t-shirt designs made up. I'm going to get one that says Team Oscar. I'm going to get one that says Team Bailey. And whoever is wearing the most of them wins. All right? We'll set the finish line for 6 weeks after I've made them. In about 4 months when none of this is relevant.
And then, so thank you for that, Oscar. We've got one from a guy called Joe Walker.
Okay.
And he sent this into our email, and I've just put it in the Discord chat for you there, mate. If you could read it out for our listeners, because I think this is relevant to the week you're having.
Okay.
And I'd like to hear you read it, because I think this is a nice one for you to read this week.
Hi guys, I just wanted to reach out and show you some love. I stumbled across your podcast a few months ago and I've been listening ever since. Aww. I've spent the last 8 months ruining my dream career as an American football coach, and your mental health check-ins have served to support my own mini downfall and subsequent self-reflection. Wow. Did we get the okay to read this?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Fucking awesome.
If it's in the inbox, it's getting read out. That's the deal.
Sounds. I'm currently thinking about a retool into a trade, and at nearly 40 years old and 16 years chasing coaching, that is scary. Luckily, my love for movies keeps me finding happiness, sadness, and solace in the stories being told on the silver screen. After the Chaplin series and your appreciation of Nolan, both Rob's series, good shout on that one, buddy. I would love to see you delve into Coppola, Scorsese, and maybe even Sergio Leone to dissect some of their beautiful character tragedies, films that I see myself connecting with far too much as an adult after falling in love with them as a child and a teen. Keep up the great work. You are inspiring me to try something similar with sports movies particularly. Love, Joe.
That would be incredible.
Do it. And
do it.
1,000% do it.
Honestly.
Come on our show and talk.
Come on our show.
Talk a sports movie, because if me and Rob are anything, it's sports buffs. You know what I mean?
I know loads about sports ball.
Yeah, there's nothing more than I love doing on a Sunday morning than scoring a touchdown at my local basketball rink. It's the 100%. It's the one thing that we can all count on as a weekend pastime. Yeah. Give me, I know a hockey puck from a football, you know, sports.
Yeah.
These are just small facts off the top of my head. If you want to delve deeper, we can. Power. Sure, jerseys, that's a sport. There you go.
I thought it was an island.
No, that's Jersey Shore.
Oh yeah, fine.
Yeah.
So genuinely though, Joe, I really recommend starting a podcast. Both Ben and I have, like you say, we had careers that we'd committed years and years and years to. We've both had things that relationships or careers or people that we've known in life or just dreams that we've tried to achieve, right? Mm. And they've all been goal-oriented. They've all been, I will do this thing and I will be happy once this thing has gotten to this stage.
Yeah.
With you, it was coaching. With me, it was music. With Ben, it was sales. Starting a podcast, or Ben dragging me onto this podcast, has genuinely been the thing that saved my life post my breakdown and post the end of my first career, because it was the first thing that I think I'd done as an adult that made me happy in the moment, and it wasn't off put to some future time and place. I'm really happy to just hang out with my friend for an hour and have a laugh and a giggle about some stupid movies, right?
Oh, I love that, it's man.
Genuinely, like, without the podcast, there's rocky roads when you're retraining. There's moments of self-doubt. Ben and I can both look back now on nearly 2 years of every week we put out an hour of content. Mm-hmm. And every week we were a little bit prouder of the episode we'd just done than we were of the one before. And it wasn't a straight line. Some weeks we're like, that's not as good. But if we go back to a year now, I fucking cringe.
Yes, yeah,
it's just improvement and improvement and improvement. But that doesn't really matter in the moment. What matters in the moment is I'm hanging out with my buddy, and he makes me feel a million times better. So, dude, start a podcast. Nothing will help you more. And if you start that podcast, get in touch. We will be the first fuckers on it.
Yeah, 1,000%, 1,000%. Also, buddy, thanks for fucking reaching out. It genuinely means the world. The one thing I'll say is, it's scary right now, but it does get better. It doesn't necessarily get easier, but it does get better. No. It's always good to sort of put yourself first and break the mold a little bit. Find yourself a little solace rather than stressing yourself out, running yourself into an early grave, chasing something that you once thought was like, this is it. Yeah. Good. Best of luck, man. Literally fucking get the podcast going. Come on the show. It'll be great.
Yeah.
It'll be great. Do it. Love you, buddy.
That's all the time. Oh, wait. That was Comment Corner.
Mm.
I'll edit pineapple. Mm-hmm. That was Comment Corner this week. Two hefty ones. I also want to shout out on TikTok. I know we chat a lot about the Instagram. It's just where we get the most response. But I've a couple of names I see a lot on TikTok. Mike Mixtape, Henry Dresser, Lauren Elcox, Ross Grant, Thomas Nickel, Erased Tapes. You're all doing God's work on that platform. We still don't know what the fuck we're doing with it. But the fact that you're there is the only reason that we're still posting.
Yeah. So I went on it
thank
today.
Thank you for all of that.
I still don't understand how to use it.
Like, me neither. I don't know what this is. And I had to upload a video and reply to comments. That's as much as I understand. Thank you so much for spending time with us, especially at the start of the week. We love each and every one of you very dearly. Mm. We will be back next week with, drumroll, Ben,
Ghostbusters Frozen Empire.
There you go, mate.
Yeah.
You had Ghostbusters last week. You've had this one this week. And now you get Frozen. It's 3 weeks of joy for you, mate, isn't it?
Yeah.
I bet you can't wait to get into Frozen Empire.
Yeah.
Most recent Ghostbusters movie. Your favorite franchise. What could go wrong?
Yeah. I mean, why not just fucking throw James Acaster at it and hope it sticks, eh? Hey, let's see what happens with that one. I've heard that that's worked well in the past.
I'm now, Ben's now going to give you a little Monday motivation to thank you and, you know, to give you a little pep talk while I just cosplay. How are you going to wrap the themes of this one up?
God knows, man. I'm on my
arse. I'm going to cosplay society.
I'm so trying.
And just tell you to consume.
I don't know, man. Fucking, if you can take away one thing from Little Shop of Horrors, chop up your enemies and just feed them to plants. Fuck it, man. It pays. You know what I mean? Chop them up. Feed them to a fucking Venus flytrap. Because you know what? Chances are you get away with it. That's what I took from this film. Enjoy your week.